and examined the oracle bone with a special glass. He called another man over to take a look. Then he asked me many questions. Where did you find this? What? How did a girl like you find such a treasure? Oh, you are the granddaughter of a bone setter. How long have you been in Hong Kong? Ah, waiting to go to America. Did someone else leave for America without this? Did you take it from him? There are plenty of thieves in Hong Kong these days. Are you one? Miss, you come back. Come back, or I'll call the police. I left that store angry and insulted. But my heart was going boom, 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 because now I knew that what was in my hand was worth a lot of money. Yet how could I sell it? It had belonged to my mother, my grandfather. It was my connection to them. How could I hand it over to a stranger so I could abandon my homeland, the graves of my ancestors? The more I thought these things, the stronger I became. Kaijin had been right. This was my character. I made a plan. I would find a cheaper place to live, yes, even cheaper than the stinky fish house, and find a job. I would save my money for a few months, and if the visa still had not come through, I would return to Peking. There, at least, I could get a job at another orphanage school. I could wait there in comfort and companionship. If Gao Ling got me the visa, fine, I would make my way back to Hong Kong. If she did not, fine, I would stay and be a teacher. That day, I moved to a cheaper place to live, a room I shared with two women, one snoring, one sick. We took turns sleeping on the cot, the snoring girl in the morning, me in the afternoon, the sick one after me. Whichever two were not sleeping wandered outside, looking for take-home work, mending shoes, hemming scarves, weaving baskets, embroidering collars, painting bowls, anything to make a dollar. That's how I lived for a month. And when the sick girl didn't stop coughing, I moved away. Lucky you didn't get TB like the other girl did, a melon vendor later told me. Now they're both coughing blood. And I thought, TB? I had pretended to have this same sickness to escape from the Japanese. And would I now escape from getting sick? Next, I lived with a Shanghai lady who had been very, very rich but was no longer. We shared a hot little room above a place where we worked boiling laundry, dipping the clothes and plugging them out with long sticks. If she got splashed, she yelled at me, even if it was not my fault. Her husband had been a top officer with the Kuomintang. A girl in the laundry told me he had been jailed for collaborating with the Japanese during the war. So why does she act so uppity? The girl said, when everyone looks down on her. The uppity lady made a rule that I could not make any sounds at night, not a cough or a sneeze or a burst of gas. I had to walk softly, pretend my shoes were made of clouds. Often she would cry, then wail to the goddess of mercy what a terrible punishment it was that she had to be with such a person, meaning me. I told myself, wait and see. Maybe your opinion of her will change, as it did with Sister Yu. But it did not. After that awful woman, I was glad to move in with an old lady who was deaf. For extra money, I helped her boil and shell peanuts all night long. In the morning, we sold the peanuts to people who would eat them with their breakfast rice porridge. During the heat of the afternoon, we slept. It was a comfortable life. Peanuts and sleep. But one day, a couple arrived, claiming to be relatives of the deaf ladies. Here we are. Take us in. She didn't know who they were, so they traced a zigzag relationship, and sure enough, she had to admit, maybe they were related. Before I left, I counted my money and saw I had enough for the train ticket to Peking at the lowest, lowest price. Again, I went to the railway station. Again, I found out the money value had gone down, down, and the price of the ticket had gone up and up to twice as much as before. I was like a little insect scurrying up a wall with the water rising faster. This time I needed a better plan to change my situation, my siching. In English and in Chinese, the words sound almost the same. On every street corner, you could hear people from everywhere talking about this. My situation is this. This is how I can improve my situation. I realized that in Hong Kong, I had come to a place where everyone believed he could change his situation, his fate, no more staying stuck with your circumstances. And there were many ways to change. You could be clever. You could be greedy. You could have connections. I was clever, of course. And if I had been greedy, I would have sold the Oracle Bone. But I decided once again I could not do that. I was not that poor in body and respect for my family. As for connections, I had only Gao Ling, now that Miss Grutoff was dead. And Gao Ling was of no use. She did not know how to be resourceful. If I had been the one to go first to America, I would have used my strength, my character, to find a way to get a visa within a few weeks at the most. Then I wouldn't be facing the troubles I had simply because Gao Ling didn't know what to do. That was the problem. Gao Ling was strong, but not always in the right ways. She had forever been mother's favorite, spoiled by pampering, and all those years in the orphanage, she had forever lived the easy life. I had helped her so much, as had Sister Yu, that she never had to think for herself. If the river turned downstream, she would never think to swim upstream. She knew how to get her way, but only if others helped her. By the next morning, I had devised a new plan. I took my little bit of money and bought the new white smock and trousers of a Ma Jie. British people were crazy for that kind of maid. Pious, refined, and clean. That was how I found a job with an English lady and her ancient mum. Their last name was Flowers. They had a house in the Victoria Peak area. It was smaller than the others nearby. More like a cottage, with a twisty narrow path and the green ferns that led to the front door. The two old English ladies lived on top, and I lived in a room on the basement floor of the cottage. Miss Passy was the daughter, 70 years old, born in Hong Kong. Her mother must have been at least 90, and her name was Lady Ina. Her husband had been a big success in shipping goods from India to China to England. Sir Flowers was how Miss Patsy called him in memory, even though he was her father. If you ask me, the Flowers part of their name stood for the flowers that made opium. That was what the shipping business was a long time ago between India and Hong Kong, and that was how lots of Chinese people found the habit. Because Miss Patsy had always lived in Hong Kong, she could speak Cantonese just like the local people. It was a special dialect. When I first went to live there, she spoke to me in the local talk, which I could not understand except for the words that sounded a little like Mandarin. Later, she mixed a bit of English, some of which I knew from living at the orphanage school. But Miss Patsy spoke English like a British person, and at first, it was very hard for me to understand. Lady Ina's words were also hard to understand. The sound spilled out as soft and lumpy as the porridge she ate every day. She was so old she was like a baby. She made messes in her panties, both kinds, stinky and wet. I know, because I had to clean her. Miss Patsy would say to me, "Lady Ina needs to wash her hands." And then I would lift Lady Ina from the sofa or bed or dining room chair. Lucky for me, she was tiny like a child. She also had a temper like one. She would shout, "No, no, 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 no," as I walked her to the bathroom, inch by inch, so slow we were like two turtles glued at the shells. She kept shouting this while I washed her, "No, no, no, no," because she did not like any water to touch her body, and especially not her head. 3 or 4 times a day, I changed and cleaned her and her panties, her other clothes, too. Miss Patsy did not want her mummy to wear diapers because that would be a big insult. So I had to wash, wash, wash so many clothes every day. At least Miss Patsy was a nice lady, very polite. If Lady Ina threw her temper, Miss Patsy had to say only 3 words in a happy voice. "Visitors are here." And Lady Ina suddenly stopped what she was doing. She would sit down, her crooked back now very straight, her hands folded on her lap. That was how she had been taught from the time she was a young girl. In front of visitors, she had to be a lady, even if it would just pretend. In that house, there was also a parrot, a big gray bird named Cuckoo. Cuckoo like the clock bird. At first, I thought Miss Patsy was calling him Cuckoo, like the Chinese word for crying, which is what he sometimes did. Coo, 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 as if he were wounded to near death. And sometimes he laughed like a crazy woman, long and loud. He could copy any kind of sound. Man, woman, monkey, baby. One day I heard a tea kettle whistle. I went running, and the tea kettle was cuckoo rocking on his branch, stretching his neck, so delighted that he had fooled me. Another time I heard a Chinese girl cry, "Papa, papa, don't beat me. Please don't beat me." And then she screamed and screamed until I thought my skin would peel off. Miss Patsy said, "Cuckoo was already bad when Sir Flowers bought him for my 10th birthday. And for 60 years, he has learned only what he wants, like so many men." Miss Patsy loved that parrot like a son, but Lady Ina always called him the devil. Whenever she heard that bird laugh, she would waddle to his cage, shaking her finger, and say something like, "You shut up!" Sometimes she would raise her finger, but before any sounds could come out of her mouth, the bird would say, "You shut up!" exactly like Lady Ina. Then Lady Ina would get confused. Wah! Had she already spoken? I could see these thoughts on her face, her head twisting this way and then that, as if two sides of her mind were having a fight. Sometimes she would go all the way to the end of the room, inch by inch, then turn around and walk back, inch by inch, raise her finger, and say, "Shut up!" And then the bird would say the same. Back and forth they went, "You shut up! You shut up!" One day, Lady Ina went up to the bird, and before she could say anything, Cuckoo said in Miss Patsy's sing-song happy voice, "Visitors are here!" Right away, Lady Ina went to the nearby chair, sat down, took out a lacy handkerchief from her sleeve, crossed her hands in her lap, closed her lips, and waited. Her blue eyes turned toward the door. So that's how I learned to speak English. To my way of thinking, if a bird could speak good English, I could too. I had to pronounce the words exactly right. Otherwise, Lady Ina would not follow my directions. And because Miss Patsy talked to her mother in simple words, it was easy for me to learn other new things to say. Stand up. Sit down. Lunch is served. Time for tea. Horrid weather, isn't it? For the next 2 years or so, I thought my situation would never change. Every month, I went to the train station, only to find the fares had gone up again. Every month I received a letter from Gao Ling. She told me of her new life in San Francisco, how hard it was to be a burden on strangers. The church that sponsored her had found her a room with an old grandmother named Mrs. Wu who spoke Mandarin. "She's very rich and acts very cheap," Gao Ling wrote. "She saves everything that she thinks is too good to eat right away. Fruit, chocolates, cashews, so she puts them on top of her refrigerator, and when they're finally too rotten to eat, that's when she puts them in her mouth and says, 'Why does everyone say this tastes so good? What's so good about it?'" This was Gao Ling's way of telling me how hard her life was. 1 month, though, I received a letter from Gao Ling that did not start with her complaints. "Good news," she wrote. "I have met two bachelors, and I think I should marry one of them. They are both American citizens, born in this country. According to my passport with the new birth year, one is a year older than I am, the other is 3 years older. So you know what it means. The older one is studying to be a doctor, the younger one a dentist. The older one is more serious, very smart. The younger is very handsome, full of jokes. It is very hard for me to decide which one I should put all my attentions on. What do you think?" When I read that letter, I had just finished cleaning up Lady Ina's bottom twice in 1 hour. I wanted to reach across the ocean and shake Gao Ling by the shoulders and shout, "Marry the one who takes you the fastest. How can you ask which one when I'm wondering how I can live from day to day?" I did not answer Gao Ling at once. I had to go to the bird market that afternoon. Miss Patsy said that Cuckoo needed a new cage. So I went down the hill and crossed over the harbor in a ferry to the Kowloon side. Every day was becoming more crowded there as people came in from China. "The civil war is growing worse," Sister Yu had written me, "with battles as fierce as those during the war with Japan. Even if you had enough money to return to Peking right now, you should not. The nationalists would say you are a communist, because Kai Jing is now called one of their martyrs, and the communists would say you are a nationalist because you lived in an American orphanage. And whichever is worse changes with each town you pass through." When I read this, I no longer had the worry of how to get back to Peking. I exchanged that for a worry over Sister Yu and Teacher Pan and his new wife. They too could be counted as enemies on either side. As I walked toward the bird market, these were the only thoughts I had. And then I felt a cold breeze run down my back, though it was a warm day. Like a ghost is right behind me, I thought. I kept walking, turning one corner, then another, and this feeling that someone was following me grew stronger. Suddenly I stopped and turned around, and a man said to me, "So it really is you." There stood Funan, Galling's husband, and now he was missing not only two fingers but his entire left hand. His face had a bad color, and his eyes were yellow and red. "Where's my wife?" he asked. I stirred the question in my head. What was the danger in answering him one way or the other? "Gone," I finally told him, and I was glad to be able to say these words. "Gone to America." "America?" He looked astonished at first, and then he smiled. "I knew that. I just wanted to see if you would tell me the truth."
"I have nothing to hide."
"Then you aren't hiding the fact that you're trying to go to America, too."
"Who says that?"
"The entire Liu family. They're panting like dogs for an opportunity to follow their daughter. Why should you go first, they say, when you aren't even really her sister? Only true relatives can be sponsored, not bastards." He gave me a smile of false apology, then added, "Husbands, of course, should be number one." I began to walk away, and he grabbed me. "You help me, I help you," he said. "Give me her address, that's all I want. If she doesn't want me to come, that's that, and you can be next in line. I won't tell the Liu family."
"I already know she doesn't want you to come. She went to America to run away from you."
"Give me her address, or I'll go to the authorities to tell them you aren't really sisters. Then you'll lose your chance to go to America as well. Same as me."
I stared at that terrible man. What was he saying? What would he really do?
I hurried away, weaving in and out of the busy crowds, until I was certain I had lost him. At the bird market, I watched from corner of my eye. I did not spend too much time bargaining, and when I had bought the cage, I quickly made my way back to the Hong Kong side, holding on tight to my documents that showed where I lived. What would Funan do? Would he really tell the authorities? How smart was he? Which authorities would he tell? That night, I wrote Galling a letter, telling her of Funan's threats.
"Only you know how tricky he is," I said. "He might also tell authority you are already married, and then you will be in trouble, especially if you marry an American."
The next day, I left the house to post the letter. As soon as I stepped into the street, I felt sudden chill again. I stuffed the letter in my blouse. Around the corner, there he was, waiting for me. "Give me some money," he said. "You can do this for your brother-in-law, can't you? Well, aren't you really my wife's sister?" For the next few weeks, he popped up like that, every time I left the house. I could not call the police. What could I say? My brother-in-law, who is not really my brother-in-law, is following me, asking me for money and the address of my sister, who is not my true sister. And then one day, when I stepped outside to go to the market, he was not there. The entire time I was out, I expected I would see him, and I was prepared to be miserable. Nothing. When I returned home, I was puzzled and felt a strange relief. Perhaps he died, I allowed myself to hope. For the next week, I saw no sign of him. I felt no sudden cold breeze. Could it be that my luck had changed? When I opened the next letter from Galling, I was convinced this was true. "I was so angry to hear that Funan has been bothering you," she wrote. "That turtle spawn will stop at nothing to satisfy himself. The only way to get rid of him for a few days is to give him money for his opium. But soon this will no longer be a problem for you. Happy news has arrived. I have found another way you can come. Do you remember the brothers I told you about? One is studying to be a dentist, the other a doctor. Their family name is Yang, and the father said a person like you can come if a person like him sponsors you as a famous visiting artist. This is like a tourist with special visiting privileges.
The family is very kind to do this, since I am not yet related to them. Of course, I cannot ask them to pay your way. But they have already completed the application and supplied the documents. The next step is for me to earn more money so we can buy the boat passage. In the meantime, you must prepare yourself to leave at any moment, obtain the boat schedules, have a doctor's examination for parasites. I read the long list she provided and was surprised at how smart she truly was. She knew so much, and I felt like a child now being guided by a worried mother. I was so happy I let tears fall right there as I wrote the ferry home. And because I was on the ferry, I did not think to be afraid when I felt a breeze. To me, it was a comfort. But then I looked up. There was Funan. One of his eyes was missing. I nearly jumped off the boat. I was so scared. It was as if I were seeing what would happen to me. "Give me some money," he said. That night, I put Precious Auntie's picture on a low table and lighted some incense. I asked her forgiveness and that of her father. I said that the gift she had given me would now buy me my freedom, and that I hoped she would not be angry with me for this as well. The next day, I sold the oracle bone to the second shop I had gone to all those months ago. With my savings as a maid, I had enough money to buy a ticket in steerage. I got the boat schedule and sent Galing a telegram. Every few days, I gave Funan money for his habit, enough to put him into dreams. And then finally, the visa was approved. I was a famous visiting artist. I sailed for America, a land without curses or ghosts. By the time I landed, I was 5 years younger. Yet I felt so old.
Part 3. Mr. Tang was in love with Lu Ling, though he had never met her. Ruth could sense this. He talked as if he knew her better than anyone else, even her own daughter. He was 80 years old, a survivor of World War II, the Civil War in China, the Cultural Revolution, and a triple coronary bypass. He had been a famous writer in China, but here his work remained untranslated and unknown. A linguistics colleague of Art's had given Ruth his name. "She is a woman of strong character, very honest," he said to Ruth on the telephone after he began to translate the pages Ruth had mailed to him. "Could you send me her picture, one when she was a young woman? Seeing her would help me say her words in English the way she has expressed them in Chinese." Ruth thought that was an odd request, but she complied, mailing him scanned copies of the photo of Lu Ling and Gao Ling with their mother when they were young, and another taken when Lu Ling first arrived in the United States. Later, Mr. Tang asked Ruth for a picture of Precious Auntie. "She was unusual," he remarked. "Self-educated, forthright, quite a rebel for her time." Ruth was bursting to ask him. Did he know whether Precious Auntie was indeed her mother's real mother? But she held off, wanting to read his translation all at one time, not piecemeal. Mr. Tang had said he would need about 2 months to finish the job. "I don't like to just transliterate word for word. I want to phrase it more naturally, yet ensure these are your mother's words, a record for you and your children for generations to come. They must be just right, don't you agree?" While Mr. Tang translated, Ruth lived at Lu Ling's house. She had told Art of her decision when he returned from Hawaii. "This seems sudden," he said as he watched her pack. "Are you sure you're not being rash? What about hired help?" Had she downplayed the problems over the last 6 months, or had Art simply not been paying attention? She was frustrated by how little they seemed to know each other. "I think it would be easier if you hired help to take care of you and the girls," Ruth said. Art sighed. "I'm sorry. It's just that the housekeepers I get from my mother keep quitting, and I can't get Auntie Gal or anyone else to take care of her, except for an occasional day here and there." Auntie Gal said that the 1 week she spent with her was worse than running after her grandkids when they were babies. But at least she finally believes the diagnosis is real, and that ginseng tea isn't a cure-all. "Are you sure something else isn't going on?" he asked, following Ruth into the cubbyhole. "What do you mean?" She took down diskettes and notebooks from the shelves. Us, you and me, do we need to talk about something more than just your mother's mind falling apart? Why do you say that? You seem, I don't know, distant, maybe even a little angry. I'm tense. Last week I saw how she really is, and it frightened me. She's a danger to herself. She's far worse than I thought, and I realized the disease is further along than I first thought. She's probably had it 6 or 7 years already. I don't know why I never noticed. So you're going to live there has nothing to do with us. No, Ruth said firmly, and then in a softer voice, I don't know. And after a long silence, she added, I remember you asked me once what I was going to do about my mother, and it struck me, yes, what am I going to do? I felt it was all up to me. I've tried to handle it the best I can, and this is it. Maybe my moving out does have to do with us, but now if there's anything wrong with us, it's secondary to what's wrong with my mom. That's all I can handle right now. Art looked uncertain. Well, when you feel you're ready to talk. He drifted off, so miserable it seemed to Ruth, she was almost tempted to assure him that nothing was really wrong. Luling was also suspicious as to why Ruth needed to live with her. Someone asked me to write a children's book with illustrations of animals, Ruth said. She was now accustomed to telling lies without feeling guilty. I was hoping you'd do the drawings, and if you did, it would be easier if we worked together here. Less noisy that way. How many animal? What kind? Luling was as excited as a child going to the zoo. Anything we want. You get to decide what to draw, Chinese style. All right. Her mother looked pleased at the prospect of being vital to her daughter's success. Ruth sighed, relieved yet sad. Why hadn't she ever asked her mother to make drawings before? She should have done it when her mother's hand and mind were still steady. It broke her heart to see her mother trying so hard, being so conscientious, so determined to be valuable. Making her mother happy would have been easy all along. Luling simply wanted to be essential, as a mother should be. Each day she went to her desk and spent 15 minutes grinding her ink stick. Luckily, many of the drawings she did were of subjects she had drawn many times for scroll paintings. Fish, horse, cat, monkey, duck. And she executed them and the characters from a neuromotor memory of the strokes. The results were shaky, yet recognizable renditions of what she once had done perfectly. But the moment Luling attempted the unfamiliar, her hand flailed in synchrony with her confusion, and Ruth became as distressed as her mother, though she tried not to show it. Every time Luling finished a drawing, Ruth praised it, took it away, then suggested a new animal to draw.
Hippo? Luling puzzled over the word. How you say in Chinese?
Never mind, Ruth said. How about an elephant? Do an elephant. You know, the one with a long nose and big ears. But Luling was still frowning.
Why you give up? Something hard may be worth more than easy. Hippo, what look like? Horn right here?
She tapped the top of her head. That's rhinoceros. That's good, too. Do a rhinoceros, then.
Not hippo?
Don't worry about it.
I'm not worry. You worry. I see this. Look your face. You're not hiding from me.
I know. I your mother.
Okay. You don't worry hippo anymore. I worry for you. Later I remember, then tell you. You be happy. Okay, now? Don't cry anymore.
Her mother was good at being quiet when Ruth was working.
Study hard. She would whisper.
But if Ruth was watching television, Luling, as she always had, figured she was not doing anything important. Her mother then gabbed about Gao Ling, rehashing her sister's greatest insults to her over the years.
She want me to go love boat cruise to Hawaii. I ask her, where I have this kind money? My social security only $750. She tell me, you too cheap. I tell her, this not cheap, this poor. I'm not rich widow. She forget she once want marry my husband. Tell me when he die. Lucky she choose other brother.
Sometimes Ruth listened with interest, trying to determine how much of the story Luling changed in each retelling, feeling reassured when she repeated the same story. but other times Ruth was simply irritated by having to listen, and this irritation made her feel strangely satisfied, as if everything was the same, nothing was wrong.
"That girl downstairs eat popcorn almost every night. Burn it, fire alarm go off. She don't know I can smell. Stink, popcorn all she eat. No wonder skinny. Then she tell me this not work right, that not work right. Always complaining, threaten me. Lawsuit, injury, code violation."
At night, as Ruth lay in her old bed, she felt she had come back to her adolescence in the guise of an adult. She was the same person, and yet she was not. Or perhaps she was two versions of herself. Ruth 1969 and Ruth 1999. One more innocent and the other more perceptive. One needier, the other more self-sufficient. Both of them fearful. She was her mother's child, and mother to the child her mother had become. So many combinations, like Chinese names and characters, the same elements, seemingly simple, reconfigured in different ways. This was the bed from her childhood, and still within those youthful moments before dreams, when she ached and wondered alone, what's going to happen? And just as in childhood, she listened to her breathing and was frightened by the idea that her mother's might one day stop. When she was conscious of it, each inhalation was an effort. Expiration was simply a release. Ruth was afraid to let go. Several times a week, Luling and Ruth would talk to ghosts. Ruth pulled out the old sand tray stored on top of the refrigerator and offered to write to Precious Auntie. Her mother reacted politely, the way people do when offered a box of chocolates.
"Oh, well, maybe just little."
Luling wanted to know if the children's book was going to make Ruth famous. Ruth had Precious Auntie say that Luling would be. Luling also asked for updates on the stock market.
"Dow Jones go up or down?" she asked one day.
Ruth drew an upward arrow.
"Sell Intel, buy Intel."
Ruth knew her mother watched the stock market mostly just for fun. She had not found any letters, junk mail or otherwise, from brokerage firms.
"Buy on sale," she decided to write.
Luling nodded.
"Oh, wait till down. Precious Auntie, very smart."
One night, as Ruth held the chopstick in her hand, ready to divine more answers, she heard Luling say,
"Why you and Artie argue?"
"We're not arguing."
"Then why you not live together? Just because me, my fault?"
"Of course not." Ruth said this a bit too loudly.
"I think maybe so."
She gave Ruth her all-knowing look.
"Long time ago, you first meet him. I tell you, why you live together first? You do this, he never marry you. You remember? Oh, now you thinking, ah, mother right, live together. Now I just left over, easy throw away. Don't be embarrassed, you be honest."
Her mother had said those things, Ruth recalled with chagrin. She busied her hands, brushing off stray grains of sand from the edges of the tray. She was both surprised by the things her mother remembered and touched by her concern. What Luling had said about art was not exactly right, yet she had pierced the heart of it, the fact that Ruth felt like a leftover, last in line to get a helping of whatever was being served. Something was terribly wrong between art and her. She had sensed that more strongly during their trial separation. Wasn't that what this was? She saw more clearly the habits of emotion, her trying to accommodate herself to him even when he didn't need her to. At one time she had thought that adjustment was what every couple, married or not, did willingly or out of grudging necessity. But had Art also accommodated to her? If so, she didn't know how. And now that they had been apart, she felt unweighted, untethered. This was what she had predicted she might feel when she lost her mother. Now she wanted to hang on to her mother as if she were her life preserver.
"What bothers me is that I don't feel lonelier without Art," she told Wendy over the phone. "I feel more myself."
"Do you miss the girls?"
"Not that much, at least not their noise and energy. Do you think my feelings are deadened or something?"
"I think you're worn out."
Twice a week, Ruth and her mother went to Vallejo Street for dinner. On those days, Ruth had to finish her work early and shop for groceries. Since she did not want to leave her mother alone, she took her along to the store. While they shopped, Lu Ling commented on the cost of every item, questioning whether Ruth should wait until it was cheaper. Once Ruth arrived home, and yes, she reminded herself, the flat on Vallejo Street was still her home, she seated Lu Ling in front of the television, then sorted through mail addressed to her and Art as a couple. She saw how little of that there was, while most of the repair bills were in her name. At the end of the night, she was frazzled, saddened and relieved to go back to her mother's house, to her little bed. One night, while she was in the kitchen cutting vegetables, Art sidled up to her and patted her bottom. "Why don't you get Gao Ling to babysit your mom? Then you can stay over for a conjugal visit." She flushed. She wanted to lean against him, wrap her arms around him, and yet the act of doing so was as scary as leaping off a cliff. He kissed her neck. "Or you can take a break right now and we can sneak into the bathroom for a quickie." She laughed nervously. "They'll all know what we're doing." "No, they won't." Art was breathing in her ear. "My mother knows everything. She sees everything." With that, Art stopped, and Ruth was disappointed. During their second month of living apart, Ruth told Art, "If you really want to have dinner together, maybe you should come to my mother's for a change, instead of my schlepping over here all the time for dinner. It's exhausting to do that all the time." So Art and the girls started to go twice a week to Lu Ling's house. "Ruth," Dory whined one night as she watched her making a salad, "when are you coming home? Dad is, like, really boring, and Thea's all the time like, 'Dad, there's nothing to do, there's nothing good to eat.'" Ruth was pleased that they missed her. "I don't know, honey. Waipo needs me." "We need you, too." Ruth felt her heart squeeze. "I know, but Waipo's sick. I have to stay with her." "Then can I come and stay here with you?" Ruth laughed. "I'd like that, but you'll have to ask your dad." 2 weekends later, Thea and Dory came with an inflatable mattress. They stayed in Ruth's room. "Girls only," Dory insisted, so Art had to go home. In the evening, Ruth and the girls watched television and drew Mendy tattoos on each other's hands. The next weekend, Art asked if it was boys' night yet. "I think that can be arranged," Ruth said coyly. Art brought his toothbrush, a change of clothes, and a portable boombox with a Michael Feinstein CD, Gershwin music. At night, he squeezed into the twin bed with Ruth, but she did not feel amorous with Lu Ling in the next room. That was the explanation she gave Art. "Let's just cuddle then," he suggested. Ruth was glad he did not press her for further explanations. She nestled against his chest. Deep into the night, she listened to his sonorous breathing and the foghorns. For the first time in a long while, she felt safe. Mr. Tang called Ruth at the end of 2 months. "Are you sure there aren't any more pages?" "Afraid not. I've been cleaning out my mother's house, drawer by drawer, room by room. I even discovered she put $1,000 under a floorboard. If there was anything else, I'm sure I would have found it." "Then I've finished." Mr. Tang sounded sad. "There were a few pages with some writing on them, the same sentences over and over, saying she was worried that she was already forgetting too many things. The script on those was pretty shaky. I think they were more recent. It may upset you. I'm just telling you now so you know." Ruth thanked him. "May I come over now to deliver my work to you?" he asked formally. "Would that be all right?" "Is that too much trouble?" "It would be an honor. To be honest, I would dearly like to meet your mother. After all this time of reading her words, day and night, I feel I know her like an old friend and miss her already." Ruth warned him. "She won't be the same woman who wrote those pages." "Perhaps, but somehow I think she will be. Would you like to come for dinner tonight?" Ruth joked with her mother that an admirer was coming to see her and she should put on her pretty clothes. "No, no one coming." Ruth nodded and smiled. "Who?" Ruth answered vaguely. "An old friend of yours in China." Luling pondered hard.
Ah, yes. I remember now.
Ruth helped her bathe and dress. She tied a scarf around her neck, combed her hair, added a touch of lipstick.
You're beautiful, Ruth said, and it was true.
Luling looked at herself in the mirror.
Beautiful. Too bad Gao Ling not pretty like me.
Ruth laughed. Her mother had never expressed vanity about her looks, but with the dementia, the modesty sensors must not have been working. Dementia was like a truth serum. At 7 exactly, Mr. Tang arrived with Luling's pages and his translation. He was a slender man with white hair, deep smile lines, a very kind face. He brought Luling a bag of oranges.
No need be so polite,
she said automatically as she inspected the fruit for soft spots. She scolded Ruth in Chinese.
Take his coat. Ask him to sit down. Give him something to drink.
No need to trouble yourself, Mr. Tang said.
Oh, your Chinese is the Beijing dialect. Very elegant, Luling said.
She became girlish and shy, which amused Ruth. And Mr. Tang, in turn, poured on the charm, pulling out Luling's chair to seat her, serving her tea first, filling her cup when it was half empty. She and Mr. Tang continued to speak in Chinese, and to Ruth's ear, her mother began to sound more logical, less confused.
Where in China are you from? Luling asked.
Tianjin. Later I went to school at Yanjing University.
Oh, my first husband went there. A very smart boy. Pan Kaijing, did you know him?
I've heard of him, Ruth heard Mr. Tang answer. He studied geology, didn't he?
That's right. He worked on many important things. Have you ever heard of Peking Man?
Of course, Peking Man is world famous.
Luling looked wistful.
He died watching over those old bones.
He was a great hero. Others admired his bravery, but you must have suffered.
Ruth listened with fascination. It was as if Mr. Tang had known her mother years before. He easily guided her to the old memories, to those that were still safeguarded from destruction. And then she heard her mother say,
My daughter, Louis, also worked with us. She was at the same school where I lived after Precious Auntie died.
Ruth turned, startled, then touched that her mother included her in the past.
Yes, I was sorry to hear about your mother. She was a great lady, very smart.
Luling tilted her head and seemed to be struggling with sadness.
She was the daughter of a bone setter.
Mr. Tang nodded.
A very famous doctor.
At the end of the evening, Mr. Tang thanked Luling elaborately for some delightful hours of remembering the old times.
May I have the honor of visiting you again soon?
Luling tittered. She raised her eyebrows and looked at Ruth.
You're welcome to come any time, Ruth said. Tomorrow, Luling blurted. Come tomorrow.
Ruth stayed up all night to read the pages Mr. Tang had translated.
Truth,
the account began. She started to enumerate all the true things she was learning, but soon lost count, as each fact led to more questions. Her mother was really 5 years older than Ruth had always thought, so that meant she had told Dr. Huey the truth about her age. And the part about not being Gao Ling's sister, that was true as well. Yet her mother and Gao Ling were sisters, more so than Ruth had ever thought. They had more reason than most sisters to disavow their relationship. Yet they had been fiercely loyal, had remained irrevocably bound to each other by grudges, debt, and love. She was elated to know this. Parts of her mother's story saddened her. Why did she feel she could never tell Ruth that Precious Auntie was her mother? Did she fear that her own daughter would be ashamed that Luling was illegitimate? Ruth would have assured her that there was no shame, that it was practically fashionable these days to be born a love child. But then Ruth remembered that as a girl, she had been terrified of Precious Auntie. She had resented her presence in their lives, had blamed her for her mother's quirkiness, her feelings of doom. How misunderstood Precious Auntie had been by both her daughter and her granddaughter. Yet there were moments when Ruth sensed that Precious Auntie had been watching her, that she knew when Ruth was suffering. Ruth mused over this, lying in her childhood bed. She understood more clearly why her mother had always wanted to find Precious Auntie's bones and bury them in the proper place.
She wanted to walk through the end of the world and make amends. She wanted to tell her mother, "I'm sorry, and I forgive you too." The next day, Ruth telephoned Art to tell him what she had read. "It feels like I found the magic thread to mend a torn-up quilt. It's wonderful and sad at the same time."
"I'd like to read it. Would you let me?"
"I want you to," Ruth sighed. "She should have told me these things years ago. It would have made such a difference," Art interrupted.
"There are things I should have said years ago, too."
Ruth fell silent, waiting.
"I've been thinking about your mother, and I've also been thinking about us."
Ruth's heart started to race.
"Remember what you said when we first met about not wanting to have assumptions about love?"
"I didn't say that. You did."
"I did."
"Absolutely, I remember."
"Funny, I thought you did."
"Ah, you assumed."
He laughed. "Your mother isn't the only one with memory problems. Well, if I said it, then I was wrong, because I do think it's important to have certain assumptions. For one thing, that the person who's with you is there for the long haul, that he'll take care of you and what comes with you, the whole package, mother and everything. For whatever reason, my having said that about assumptions and you're going along with it, well, I guess I thought it was great at the time that I had love on a free ride. I didn't know what I was going to lose until you moved out."
Art paused. Ruth knew he was waiting for her to respond. In part, she wanted to shout with gratitude that he had said what she had been feeling and could not express. Yet she was scared that he was saying this was too late. She felt no joy in hearing his admission. She felt sad.
"I don't know what to say," she finally admitted. "You don't have to say anything. I just wanted you to know. The other thing is, I really am worried about your taking care of your mother over the long term. I know you want to do this, that it's important, and she needs someone around. But you and I know she's going to get worse. She'll require more and more care, and she can't do it alone, and neither can you. You have your work and a life, too, and your mother would be the last person to see you give that up for her sake."
"I can't keep hiring new housekeepers."
"I know. That's why I've been reading up on Alzheimer's, stages of the disease, medical needs, support groups, and I've thought of an idea, a possible solution, an assisted living residence."
"That's not a solution." Ruth felt as she had when her mother showed her the $10 million check from the magazine sweepstakes.
"Why not?"
"Because my mother would never go for it. I wouldn't go for it. She'd think I was sending her to the dog pound. She'd threaten to kill herself every single day."
"I'm not talking about a nursing home and bedpans. This is assisted living. They're the latest concepts, the wave of the baby boomer future, like senior club meds, meals, maid service, laundry, transportation, organized outings, exercise, even dancing. And it's supervised, 24 hours. It's upscale, not depressing at all. I've already looked at a bunch of residences, and I've found a great one, not far from where your mother lives now."
"Forget it. Upscale or not, she would never live in a place like that."
"All she has to do is try it."
"I'm telling you, forget it. She won't do it."
Whoa, before you dismiss the idea outright, tell me the specific objections. Let's see if we can move forward from there."
"There's nothing to move forward. But if you must know, for one thing, she'd never leave her own home. And second, there's the cost. I assume these places aren't free, which is what it would have to be for her to even consider it. And if it were free, she'd think it was welfare, so she'd refuse on those grounds."
"All right. I can deal with those factors. What else?"
Ruth took a deep breath. "She'd have to love it. She would have to want to live there as her choice, not yours or mine."
"Done. And she can come stay with you and me anytime she wants."
Ruth noted that he said, "you and me." She let down her guard. Art was trying. He was telling her he loved her in the best way he knew possible.
2 days later, Luling showed Ruth an official-looking notice from the California Department of Public Safety on letterhead generated from Art's computer.
"Radon leak,"
Lu Ling exclaimed. What this mean, radon leak?
Let me see, Ruth said and scanned the letter. Art had been very clever. Ruth played along.
It's a heavy gas, it says. Radioactive, dangerous to your lungs. The gas company detected it when they did a routine inspection for earthquake dangers.
The leakage isn't from a pipe. It comes from the soil and rocks under the house, and they need you to move out for 3 months while they do an environmental assessment and hazard removal via intensive ventilation.
How much cost?
Nothing, it says. The city does it for free. Look, they even pay for the place where you stay while they do the ventilation. 3 months free rent, including food. The Miramar Manor, located near your current residence, it says, with amenities typical of a 5-star hotel. That's the highest rating, 5 stars. They're asking you go there as soon as possible.
Free 5-star for 2 people?
Ruth pretended to search the fine print.
No, looks like it's just for 1 person. I can't go. She sighed, sounding disappointed.
I don't mean you, her mother exclaimed. What about that girl downstairs?
Oh, right. Ruth had forgotten about the tenant. So had Art, evidently. But her mother, brain disease and all, hadn't let that slip by.
I'm sure she got a similar notice. They wouldn't let anyone remain in the building. Not if it can give them lung disease.
Lu Ling frowned.
Then she lived my same hotel?
Oh, no, it's probably different, a place that isn't as nice, I'm sure, since you're the owner and she's only the renter.
But she still pay me rent.
Ruth looked at the letter again.
Of course, that's the law.
Lu Ling nodded with satisfaction.
Okay, then.
By phone, Ruth told Art that his plan seemed to have worked. She was glad that he didn't sound smug.
It's kind of scary how easily fooled she was, he said. That's how a lot of old people get swindled out of their homes and savings.
I feel like a spy right now, Ruth added, like we succeeded at a covert mission.
I guess she and a lot of other people will buy into any idea that involves getting something for nothing.
Speaking of which, how much will this Miramar place cost?
Don't worry about it.
Come on, tell me.
I'll take care of it. If she likes it and stays, we'll figure it out later. If she hates it, the 3 months are on me. She can move back into her old place and we'll think of something else.
Ruth liked that he was thinking we again.
Well, we'll share the cost of the 3 months then.
Just let me do this, okay?
Why should I?
Because it feels like the most important thing I've done in a long time. Call it a Boy Scout good deed for the day, mitzvah gathering, mensch remedial training, temporary insanity. It makes me feel good, like a human being. It makes me happy.
Happy. If only her mother could be happy as well, living in a place like the Miramar.
Ruth wondered what made people happy. Could you find happiness in a place, in another person? What about happiness for herself? Did you simply have to know what you wanted and reach for it through the fog?
As they parked in front of the 3-story shingled building, Ruth was relieved to see that it did not look like an asylum. Lu Ling was at her sister's for the weekend, and it was Art's idea that they visit Miramar Manor without her so that they could anticipate what objections she might raise. Miramar Manor was flanked by windswept cypress trees and looked out on the ocean. The wrought iron fence held a plaque declaring that this was a San Francisco landmark, erected as an orphanage after the great earthquake. Ruth and Art were ushered into an oak-paneled office and told that the director of care services would be with them soon. They sat stiffly on a leather sofa, facing a massive desk. Framed diplomas and health certifications hung on the wall, as well as old photographs of the building and its original incarnation, with beaming girls posed in white frocks.
"Sorry to keep you waiting,"
she heard someone say in a British accent. Ruth turned and was surprised to see a polished-looking young Indian man in suit and tie.
"Edward Patel," he said, smiling warmly.
He shook hands and handed them each a business card. He must be in his early 30s, Ruth thought. He looked like a stockbroker, not someone who concerned himself with laxatives and arthritis medication.
"I'd like to start here," Patel said, taking them back to the foyer.
because this is what our seniors first see when they arrive. He began what sounded like an oft-recited spiel. Here at Miramar Manor, we believe home is more than a bed. It's a whole concept.
Concept? Ruth looked at Art. This would never work. What does the PNF and PNF Healthcare stand for? Art asked, looking at the business card.
Patel and Finkelstein. One of my uncles was a founding partner. He's been in the hospitality business a long time. Hotels. Morris Finkelstein is a doctor. His own mother is a resident here.
Ruth marveled that a Jewish mother would allow her son to put her in a place like this. Now that was an endorsement.
They stepped through French doors into a garden surrounded by hedges. On each side was a shady arbor, with a lattice covering of jasmine. Underneath were cushioned chairs and opaque glass-topped tables. Several women glanced up from their conversations.
"Hello, Edward," three of them sang out in turn. "Morning, Betty, Dorothy, Rose. Wow, Betty, that's a spectacular color on you." "You watch it, young lady," the old woman said sternly to Ruth. "He'll sell the pants off you if he can."
Patel laughed easily, and Ruth wondered whether the woman was only joking. Well, at least he knew their names. Down the middle of the garden was a reddish pathway lined with benches, some shaded by awnings. Patel pointed out amenities that might have gone unnoticed to an untrained eye. His voice was resonant, familiar, and knowledgeable, like that of an English teacher Ruth had once had. The strolling path, he explained, had the same covering used for indoor running tracks. No loose bricks or stones to catch a feeble walker off guard, no hard concrete. Of course, if a senior fell, she could still break a hip, he said, but it was less likely to shatter into a million pieces.
"And studies show that's what's so deadly to this population. One fall, boom!"
Patel snapped his fingers. "Happens a lot when the elderly live alone, and in the old family home that hasn't been adapted to their needs. No rampways, no handrails." Patel gestured to the flowers in the garden.
"All thorn-free and non-toxic, no deadly oleander or foxglove that a confused person might nibble on."
Each plant was identified by staked marker at eye level. No bending down necessary.
"Our seniors really love naming the herbs. On Mondays, the afternoon activity is herb collecting. There's rosemary, parsley, oregano, lemon, thyme, basil, sage. The word echinacea gives them a hard time, though. One lady calls it the China Sea. Now we all call it that."
The herbs from the garden, Patel added, were used in the meals. The ladies still pride themselves in their cooking abilities.
They love to remind us to add only a pinch of oregano, or to rub the sage on the inside, not the outside of the chicken, that sort of thing.
Ruth could picture dozens of old ladies complaining about the food, and her mother yelling above the rest that everything was too salty. They continued walking along the path toward a greenhouse at the back of the garden.
"We called this the love nursery," Patel said
as they stepped into a blast of color. Shocking pink and monk robe saffron. The air was moist and cool.
"Each resident has an orchid plant. The flower pots are painted with the names they've given their orchids. As you may have already noticed, about 90% of our residents are women, and no matter how old they are, many still have a strong maternal instinct. They adore watering their orchids every day. We use a dendrobium orchid known as Cuthbertsoni. Blooms nearly year-round, non-stop. And unlike most orchids, it can take daily watering. Most of our residents have named their orchids after their husbands or children or other family members who've already passed. They often talk to their plants, touch and kiss the petals, fuss and worry over them. We give them tiny eyedroppers in a bucket of water we call love potion. Mother's coming, mother's coming, you'll hear them say. It's quite touching to watch them feeding their orchids."
Ruth's eyes welled up. Why was she crying? "Stop this," she told herself. "You're being stupid and maudlin. He's talking about a business plan, for God's sake. Concept-sanctioned forms of happiness." She turned away as if to inspect a row of orchids. When she had collected herself, she said, "They must love it here."
"They do. We've tried to think of everything that a family would think about."
"Or wouldn't," Art said.
"There's a lot to think about," Patel said with a modest smile.
"Do you ever find any of them reluctant to be here, especially in the beginning?
Oh, yes, indeed. That's expected. They don't want to move out of their old homes because that's where all the memories are, and they don't want to spend down there a kid's inheritance, nor do they think they're old. Certainly not that old, they'll say. I'm sure we'll be saying the same thing when we're their age.
Ruth laughed to be polite. We may have to trick my mother into coming here.
Well, you won't be the first family members to do so, Patel said. The subterfuges people have used to get their parents here, wow, pretty ingenious. It could fill a book.
Like what? Ruth asked.
We have quite a few folks here who don't know it costs anything to live here.
Really? Art exclaimed, and gave Ruth a wink.
Oh, yes, their sense of economy is strictly Depression era. Paying rent is money down the drain. They're used to owning a house, paid free and clear.
Ruth nodded. Her mother's building had been paid up last year. They continued along the walkway and went inside and down a hall toward the dining room.
One of our residents, Patel added, is a 90-year-old former sociology professor, still fairly sharp, but he thinks he's here on a fellowship from his alma mater to study the effects of aging. And another woman, a former piano teacher, thinks she's been hired to play music every night after dinner. She's not too bad, actually. We direct bill most families, so their parents don't even know what the fees are.
Is that legal? Ruth asked.
Perfectly. As long as the families have conservatorship or power of attorney over the finances. Some of them take out loans against the principal on the house, or they've sold their parents' house and used the money in trust to make the payments. Anyway, I know all the problems of getting seniors to accept the idea of even considering living in a place like this. But I guarantee you, once your mother has lived here for a month, she'll never want to leave.
What do you do? Ruth joked. Spike the food?
Patel misunderstood. Actually, because of all the dietary needs of our population, we can't prepare anything too spicy. We do have a nutritionist who makes up the monthly menu. Most of the choices are low-fat, low-cholesterol. We also offer vegan. The residents receive printed-out menus every day.
He picked one off a nearby table. Ruth scanned it.
The choice today was turkey meatloaf, tuna casserole, or tofu fajitas, accompanied by salad, rolls, fresh fruit, mango sorbet, and macaroons.
Suddenly another problem loomed. No Chinese food. But when she brought it up, Patel was ready with an answer.
We've encountered this issue in the past. Chinese, Japanese, kosher food, you name it. We have a delivery service from approved restaurants. And since we have two other Chinese residents who get takeout twice a week, your mother can share the selections we get for them. Also, one of our cooks is Chinese. She makes rice pudding on the weekends for breakfast. Several of our non-Chinese residents go for that as well.
Patel returned smoothly to his rehearsed patter.
Regardless of special diets, they all love the waiter service, tablecloths at the meals, just like a fine restaurant. And no tipping is necessary or allowed.
Ruth nodded.
Luling's idea of a big tip was a dollar. It's really a carefree life, which is how it should be when you're this age, don't you agree?
Patel looked at Ruth. He must have picked her as the stumbling block. How could he tell? Did she have a crease in the middle of her brow? It was obvious that Art thought the place was great. Ruth decided she would get hard-nosed.
Are any of the people here, you know, like my mother? Do any of them have, well, memory problems of some sort?
It's safe to assume that half the general population over 85 likely has some memory problems starting to show. And after all, our average age here is 87.
I don't mean just memory problems. What if there's something more...
You mean like Alzheimer's? Dementia?
Patel motioned them into another large room. I'll get back to your question in just a minute. This is the main activity hall.
Several people looked up from a bingo game being conducted by a young man. Ruth noticed that most were nicely dressed. One was wearing a powder blue pantsuit, a pearl necklace and earrings, as if she were going to Easter services. A beak-nosed man in a jaunty beret winked at her. She imagined him at 30, a brash businessman, confident of his position in the world and with the ladies.
Bingo!
A woman with almost no chin shouted.
I haven't called enough numbers yet, Anna, the young man said patiently.
You need at least 5 to win. We've only done 3 so far.